But the fact is we have eliminated hunting behavior from snakes for in effectively all instances. You know, slapping it in the face with a frozen thawed rat or just dangling in front is not the same as having that snake run it down in a burrow. It's just not. And part of me wonders if some of these species, one of the triggers for breeding, is in fact hunting behavior.
Welcome back to the Animals at Home podcast. My name is Dylan Perrin, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Today, I'm speaking with Jamie Woods. Jamie is, well, he's been on the network before, the Animals at Home network, as he did episode number 43 with Project Herpeticulture with Roy and Phil. I highly recommend going to listen to that episode as well. I'll make sure it's in the show notes. And he also recently posted a blog post on the Animals at Home blog, which I'll also include in the show notes as well. And he comes from a background of both fish keeping and reptile keeping, and has a really interesting, unique perspective on how those two hobbies overlap and how we can learn things that the aquarium hobby is doing really well and potentially pull over onto the reptile side. So for the meat and potatoes of this episode, we discuss the lack of biofeedback in our reptile enclosures. We discuss the importance of potentially adding hunting behavior, hunting opportunities for our reptiles, whether that and the ethics of that, ethics of live feeding and whatnot. We cover how important it is to establish consistent and thorough frameworks when it comes to breeding new species in herpeticulture, and also wrap up the conversation with a discussion on technology and how it's advancing and how it's changing the landscape of both the aquarium world and the herpeticulture world. And there's so much more in this episode as well. Jamie is a really fascinating individual, and let's just jump into it. Enjoy. Well, Jamie, welcome to the podcast and welcome back to the podcast network.
Thanks, dude. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this chat. For those that didn't catch Project Herpeticulture episode with Jamie, I think that was last June, I want to say, episode number 43. So I'll make sure that's all in the show notes for people, because we'll kind of rehash some of that and we'll kind of get into a little more detail as well. For those who haven't listened to that episode yet, maybe we can just do a quick brief background of yourself, kind of the where you're coming from as far as the information that you've collected over the years, and then we'll do a quick summary of that episode as well. But let's start with just a little bit about yourself.
Sure thing, man. So my background in the hobby started since I was a child. My dad was actually big into the reptile hobby and also aquariums, and they kind of intermingled throughout my entire life. So I remember, like, probably the first memory I have, to be honest, is that I got a Honduran milk snake for Christmas when I was probably five. And it was just like one of those moments that's just stuck with me. You know, it's like Christmas morning, getting handed this orange and black snake and being told, you know, what's you know, here, it's yours. Oh, it might, you know, if it bites, it's okay. You know, like, you're going to be all right, you know, just walking through that. And then as I grew up, I was in a position where my parents were divorced. And so my mom didn't let me keep reptiles at the house, but my dad always had them. So we would go to Daytona Reptile Show. At the time, it was in Orlando. And I've been going to Daytona. I was thinking about this yesterday. So first one was in 96. I think I've gone to basically 25 of the 27 or 28 in that time frame.
Wow.
Like, it was just a yearly rite of passage. We'd go to Daytona. Even if I didn't have any animals at the time, we'd still go to Daytona. So it's been nice to be able to kind of keep my finger on the pulse in terms of what's going on, at least with that show. I know Tinley, in the meantime, has kind of become the larger of the NARBC shows, from what I understand. But at the time, you know, Daytona was just cranking. So then as I was growing up, my mom wouldn't let me have the reptiles, but she was okay with aquariums. The fish, you know, the fish were totally fine. So I started gravitating towards that, and I found that I really, really enjoyed aquariums as well. And then when I was 14, I was offered a job at a local aquarium store, and we only sold fish, and, you know, I mean, invertebrates and everything as well, but just aquatic life. They had the way the store was, it was beautiful. You walked in the front, we had all of our displays, and then a dark room on the left with all freshwater, and then a dark room on the right with all saltwater. And so we bring in wild cods. They would do a lot of aquaculture in terms of either fish or also a lot with the corals at the time, which was extremely unusual because most of it was still wild caught. Now at this point, you'd be hard pressed to find more wild caught corals because there's a lot of countries that have restricted it. But I worked at the aquarium store, and at the same time, my dad was still keeping reptiles. And he was big into breeding dart frogs. So growing up, I actually would help him with dart frog projects, and we would build, you know, vivariums for them. And it was generally some of the easier to keep species. So he liked Tinctorius, Azurius, you know, there's just some of the dendrobatids like that are a larger, easier to keep, easier to breed. And then throughout my life, he started keeping the ophagas, you know, the obligates. And so that was a good experience. He also was big into, I would call him like a Noah's Ark person. He either liked it or he didn't, but it was like, oh, okay, we're going to have this these chameleons, you know, and try to breed them. And he was big into the breeding side until I was probably 15 or 16. I never really cared about breeding. I was much more of just a pure hobbyist. Like I had a Colombian boa. I had, you know, just a bunch of snakes, random snakes, and like rosy boas, you know, stuff like that. But I never considered breeding, which was opposite of the way the fish went. The fish, I was much more into breeding pretty much immediately. Some of that is because fish can breed, quote unquote, on accident, you know, if you get them. Right. Like a lot of people with guppies will get them, and then it just goes that way. So this was until I worked at that aquarium store from age 14 to 24. Then I went to college and got out completely of both reptiles and fish. But what I was still doing, like I said, is I was going to Daytona every single year, regardless, because my dad would grab frogs or we'd grab feeders or, you know, anything, equipment, whatever we needed. So I was able to kind of watch and observe the hobby. And then one of my routines when I was in school was in Gainesville, where I went to school with, there was an aquarium store and a reptile store literally right next to each other. Mm-hmm. And then across the street was the Natural History Museum. So on Sundays, I would get up, I would hit the Natural History Museum, go look at the invertebrates they had. They have a butterfly garden, huge collection of tried and pinned invertebrates, which is really beautiful, really cool. And then I would go to the reptile store and the fish store, and it was just killing me not to get something. You know, like, you know how it is. You walk into these stores, man, and it's like, you see so much cool stuff, and the hobby has progressed. There's so much more available of certain things and less of others. But eventually I went to a Daytona and cracked. I couldn't take it anymore. I looked, I saw a Woma python for the first time that I remember seeing it. And so I did like the classic. I was not involved in the hobby, like with the racks or anything. So I did the classic, okay, I'm going to look up what a Woma python needs in terms of care online. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, they're Australian, they're desert species. If you worked with, you know, desert species, you know that, okay, that means they can take extreme fluctuations. They're going to want more sun. Let's do a sand substrate. So I set this thing up in Mexoterra, and I remember looking at it and being like, well, I'm back. I'm never going to stop, you know? So that was kind of the turning point. I had that snake for a few years and gave her to a friend to breed, because again, I was not into the breeding aspect. And then I had to move down for work and couldn't take her. She was I kept that Woma in a 6 foot by 2 foot by 2 foot enclosure. To be honest with you, I never thought any different than just doing a big enclosure. So I did that. And then I finally got back in recently with doing arboreal snakes. I'd wanted green tree pythons since I was 6. I remember seeing them at Orlando, like in these containers, you know, the little red green tree pythons and the yellow green tree pythons. And my dad at the time was like, absolutely not, you know, the care is not nailed down. So once I got back in, I've kind of stuck with the arboreal snakes at this point. I don't have any right now because I'm looking at doing another move, and I wasn't certain if I was going to move out of state. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were talking a little bit before, but in the United States, like, depending on what state you are, very heavily influences what your collection can legally look like. You know, like if you go a state above me, I'm in Florida right now, so I have heavy restrictions on snakes. But if I go to Georgia, the restrictions almost flip. Like Florida doesn't have a lot of restrictions on native species, with the exception of the indigo snake. But Georgia, on the other hand, has a ton of regulations on native species and or very little on exotic. So had I been moving to Atlanta, let's say, I could have basically flipped my collection. All of a sudden, if I had a pine snake, it might be a problem. But if I had a scrub python, it's fine. Whereas it's reversed in Florida.
Right. Yeah. So slowly kind of, you know, potentially going to get back in at some point. But it's an interesting upbringing coming up through, you know, doing both at the same time. And you kind of have a good image of watching each hobby sort of develop over the years. I'm curious, can you quickly tell the story? Is it datnoids? Is that how you pronounce that species of something like that?
It's close enough, dude. I would say that's how I always pronounce it. It's like datnoides or something, but come on. Like, you know, that language is dead for a reason. So
Exactly. So actually, one thing I forgot to mention for those that that didn't know, Jamie also published a really great article that we put up on Animals at Home blog. And this is kind of a little bit of the frame for this discussion as well. And you told a kind of a great story at the beginning of that article just about your experience early on keeping fish and then, you know, and I think, and then coming back into fish a little bit later in life and having a, you know, a pretty profound experience and how that probably will affect or has affected your reptile keeping as well. So maybe you could kind of tell us that story.
Yeah, man. So when I remember reading a book that talked about the general progression of reptile keepers, and it effectively went from like small to large to venomous. That's kind of the path. You know, I think it was Stolen World that says that, but fish generally take a similar path. Like you'll see people who have been in the hobby long enough, they seem to go from small to large to not necessarily venomous, but the predatory fish. And so the Siamese tiger fish are a genus, Datinoides, that consists of, I think at this point, six species, somewhere around there. They're generally found in Asia, you know, anywhere from Thailand to New Guinea actually has one. So when I was in the hobby at the time, this would have been the early 2000s, probably 2003, 2004. Siamese tiger fish were still available in the hobby, and that's Datinoides pulcher. So there's other ones that are called Siamese tiger fish, but they were called wide bar. They're far and away the most beautiful of the species. There's slight, you know, slight differences from the ones you'll see nowadays. But that species at the time, it was known that basically there was no captive breeding. You know, there was rumors of captive breeding, and specifically in Japan. But to be honest with you, what occurred was even at that time, people knew the populations were unstable in the wild. They're generally from areas where a lot of pollution is put into the rivers. They're also, at the time, Siamese tiger fish, and they probably still to this day, were considered, it's not, I hate to call it like a considered a symbol of wealth, but they're very similar to arowana in certain cultures where they're looked upon as like good luck charms, you know, in a way. And so they were exceptionally popular. They were not as popular in the United States, but I managed to get a breeding size, because they were, you know, 14 inches or so, trio from a gentleman out in California at the time. And this would have been when I was 15, 16. And I kept them. And, you know, I knew they were wild caught. We all knew they were imperiled. And over the course of, you know, probably 4 years, I had them. I never even thought to breed them. I was just like, hell yeah, I've got these fish. No one else has them, you know, because they're not endangered, but they're close. Like, you know, this is probably my only time to get them, but it never occurred to me at the time to actually try to breed them, you know. And they were still around in the hobby, but the prices started climbing, as you could see. And then unfortunately we had a hurricane hit and I lost everything I had. I mean, the power was out for, I think, like 9 days, like so long that the generators I was using, we just ran out of gas for. Like, there's nothing you can do at that point. Yeah, you're stuck. Like, all these big fish, you breathe it, you know, or respirating all the time. As the water temperature increases, it starts making them panic, and there was nothing I could do. It was horrible. I lost those. I lost a few other fish that were really, really near and dear to me. So, you know, I got out of the hobby, the fish hobby, and then when I got back in and started doing the reptiles, I messaged a guy who I knew from back then, who was also a distributor of, you know, a bunch of fish. He was basically known as the rare fish guy. I said, hey, have you seen, you know, pulcher? I haven't seen them available. I don't know what's going on. And he told me, he goes, man, they're gone. You know, like, we're talking, just if you see them, it's probably going to be 10 grand a fish. They're just, you know, completely gone. I find, and when he said that, I said, you know, I'm going to Google what's going on. Near extinct, if not extinct. Recently, I did see that he posted a trio available, and he said they were captive born, but I have a feeling. This is nothing against that guy, because you can only do what you can to a certain point. They have to take on face value what they're told, but it's very similar to a reptile hobby, where it's somehow miraculously these very endangered / very threatened animals just seem to be captive born in these places where there's never been any sort of protocol ever that's come out of there that says they're captive born. Yes. You know what I mean? So and that's had a huge impact on the way I think about getting back into reptiles, because at the end of the day, like, if someone came in the hobby now and said, I wanted a Siamese tigerfish, there's ones that look like them, but you're never going to see the ones. Like, you know, the chances of you seeing one in person, if you live in the United States, Canada, this area, there's still some over in Asia that I see posted available occasionally, and they're huge, which means they're old. And, you know, the chance of someone seeing it is just non-existent. And to be honest with you, it's very, very likely that the ones that weren't killed by environmental destruction were just fished out for the aquarium hobby. You know, it's they were exceptionally valuable. And as there's less of them, they become more valuable. And in a way, unfortunately, our hobby seems to, you know, turn rare animals into even more expensive commodities instead of going the other way with them.
Yeah, yeah. And that's pretty a bizarre experience, I'm sure, just because of it's actually a pretty short time window between when you were keeping them and when you tried to get back in. It's not like you're going back 30 or 40 years later and like, oh, no, we don't have these anymore. It's only, you know, a decade or so and they're gone.
Yeah, man. I mean, you can see it in the reptile hobby, too, because, again, I told you I was always on the lookout. I was looking at kingsnake. Classic example is I love green tree pythons. The variety of green tree python localities now is substantially less than it was 10 years ago. Mm. And it's virtually impossible to find locality animals that are being captive bred. There are people doing it. I'm not trying to offend anyone, but the truth is compared to the animals that come in, the amount of captive bred ones or locality animals is so small that it's virtually non-existent. And then on the import side, they're just not bringing in the localities. And it's, you know, it's very similar. We're talking a 10-year time frame, not 30, 40, 50 years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's pretty definitely eye-opening, and then it certainly lays a foundation for, okay, if we are gonna, you know, participate in the practice of keeping exotic animals or wild animals, we have to do this in a way that is, you know, we're always going to admit there's probably some selfishness to this practice, but can we minimize the selfishness and can we actually help the animals in some way and do it in a way that makes sense? So why don't we quickly just review a little bit of the episode that you did with Phil and Roy over at Project Herpeticulture, just to give people a little bit more foundation. But I'll just encourage people to go listen to that episode, because you also do go off on, like, the three of you go off on some other tangents that are super interesting in that episode as well that we won't talk about today. So you should go listen to it. But why don't we just quickly, I would love for you to define, you kind of laid out, and this is what you laid out in the article as well, the hobbyist breeder, and then sort of professional breeder as sort of three different ways you've categorized folks in the hobby. Can you run through that for us?
Yeah, sure thing. So, you know, the entire articles, the reason I wrote the article was not to just try to call out the reptile hobby. It was just a simple, like, you know, compare, contrast, maybe we can learn from some other hobby. And, you know, so there's been instances where I have learned information from a hobby that I'm not particularly interested in myself, but it informs my reptile keeping. Like, I'm not, to be honest with you, recently I've become more of it, but I wasn't a plant person. So, you know, but being able to, if someone gave me an article and said, here's what plant people can teach you, you know, and help with reptile hobby, you know, that would be extremely valuable to me. So I was thinking, okay, well, maybe I can at least get the dialogue started. From an aquarium, you know, to reptile hobby. So the way that I have kind of broken out the hobby, and, you know, I'm talking at the beginning about the aquarium hobby, is you see professional breeders, and a professional breeder in an aquarium hobby sense will generally be on a scale that you just do not see the reptile hobby. And a lot of that, we can call it herpeticulture if we'd like. You know, some people have an issue with calling it a hobby, which is fair. I personally have an issue calling it an industry because I've seen it prior. So, well, I guess we'll split the difference, go for pediculture. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you're talking professional breeders for the aquarium hobby, for, you know, aquaculture, you see a lot of times they're on a scale that's just very difficult to match. They're in South Florida. They normally run a band around the entire world. So Southeast Asia and South Florida have very similar weather patterns, which allows you to grow most tropical fish in large outdoor ponds if they're capable of doing that. So, you know, basically what they do is they will have minimal to no items in the pond, or if they're keeping species that require either being broken apart due to aggression or so small that they would get lost in the pond, they'll be in aquariums. But we're talking substrateless aquariums. That way it's ease of cleaning, the same exact reason you hear of it in the reptile in herpeticulture. And then you have an economy of scale, right? Like, the whole point is to have an economy of scale to be able to bring down the pricing. And then what you see is then in the middle, you have effectively what I call hobbyist breeders. And, you know, Dylan, your podcast, in my opinion, with TC Houston, where he talks about small batch breeding, is to me the most important podcast in the entire herpeticulture sphere. I think that when I heard that, I was like, this is it. This is what, you know, people are not understanding. So you have in the aquarium hobby, you have hobbyist breeders, and you'll see them on YouTube. You can look them up. You know, it's these guys, and they'll have 75 aquariums in their garage, and they'll be breeding these species that are not capable of being produced economically on a scale that could fill the entire aquarium hobby. You know, and what I mean by that is people seem to misunderstand what a professional would look like in this situation. They have to be able to keep an economy of scale that makes this viable. You know, selling a, let's say a fish is $2 in a store, that person's not getting $2 for it wholesale, right? You know, you have to be able to bring in and reproduce thousands upon thousands upon thousands of them to fill the market and to keep the price down. And their care is accordingly based on that, right? So like, you know, these professional breeders are looking and saying, okay, I can buy fish food X and it's going to cost me 0.05 cents per fish, or I can buy fish food Y and it's going to cost me 0.03 cents per fish. They, on a large enough scale, that those differences matter, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what the professional hobbyists or professional breeders would do. So where the hobbyist breeders have a good role to play is, if it's not your job, you have a lot more flexibility in what you can and can't keep. And I think that this specific group has an extremely important part to play when it comes to herpetoculture, because these are the people who are able to work with species that are either new and therefore not established and try to figure out if they're established, or species that require something that, you know, in a way would make them uneconomical to breed at a large scale. So like, take, for example, any of the large monitors, right? You're not going to be able to breed large monitors in a scale that makes sense for the hobby. You know, it just doesn't. You're not going to be able to make the money. They eat too much. They need too much light. If you're keeping them outside, there's only specific places you'd be able to do that year round. And a lot of those states ban those species, you know, like Florida banning tegus is a classic example. South Florida was probably one of the best places you could grow to, you know, keep, or central and South Florida was one of the best places you could produce tegus on a large scale, and you can't do it anymore. So what the hobbyist breeders are capable of doing, because they're not tied to the financial whims of the hobby, they're able to work with species and hopefully write down their observations to try to progress the species. You know, and what I mean by that is you could have a situation where hobbyist breeders are saying, okay, we're 10 generations in, we figured it out. And then a professional breeder might be able to look at that and say, you know, I think I can modify my setup to breed those. Now that I see that the species that were going for $45, I could do it for, let's say, $10 a fish and sell them for $25. That's, you know, that's a good market for them. So they will be able to take it and run with it. On the other hand, the hobbyist breeders also can keep the animals in a way that if a hobbyist has a problem with the way professional breeders are doing it, then you could have a hobbyist breeder come in and say, okay, here's how I'm keeping them. It aligns more with what you're doing. So here's what, you know, I would recommend being able to keep them like I'm keeping them. It might be a more expensive way that would price out the ability of a professional breeder to actually keep it that way. You know, and then I define hobbyists as just, you know, individuals who are in this, who don't necessarily, you know, you might breed, like I said, sometimes like aquarium hobbyists in particular, you accidentally have some breedings, but it's not the goal. The goal is just to enjoy the animal, to enjoy learning about them. And, you know, to me, I think the hobbyists in a lot of ways have been let off the hook. And I hate to say, I don't mean that as negative as it sounds, but frankly, the hobbyists, you know, are the ones, they vote with their dollar. If you're buying something from a large breeder that you have a problem with the way they keep it, they're never going to change.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, they got the money. You know, it's like when I used to see people would come into my store and they would tell me, hey, I just saved X, Y, and Z fish from, you know, big box store number one. And I would say, well, what do you mean? And they would say, well, I bought it. And then, you know, I'm managing to make it, you know, heal it, fix it, whatever. And they were doing that kindness to the heart. So I would say, that's great. You know, like, that's really awesome. Here's how we can fix it and everything. But at the end of the day, what I would have to tell these, you know, when they would leave, I would look over my coworkers and I'd be like, all they did to that company, who all they see is P&L, profit and loss, and fish bought, brought in, fish that died and fish that sold, that one went in the sell column. So now they say, okay, I've bought enough of these, saved enough of these to where it's worth bringing in. So at the end of the day, you kind of have to, vote with your dollar. So yeah, as far as the definitions go, we got professional breeders who are doing this on a scale where they will generally have minimal care and they're thinking about every single thing that goes into this. Then you have hobbyist breeders who might have a higher standard of care, but less animals and are not tied as financially. And then you have the hobbyists on both sides, reptiles and fish, who, you know, primarily are interested in having one to, you know, let's say 10 animals. I mean, that's just arbitrary. It could be whatever, but you know, you can tell when someone thinks of themselves as a hobbyist, and that's, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And I think the stigma that just being a hobbyist is a problem needs to go away.
Mm. Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. It's funny how there's like a cred that you seem to lack, a credibility that you seem to lack if you don't breed, which is, you know, I think that actually is, gives people imposter syndrome unnecessarily, and also makes people jump into breeding so they can say that they've bred in order to give themselves credibility, when, like you said, it's kind of pointless. You know, you can do a lot as just a keeper and learn a lot with your species without having to jump into reproducing animals.
Yeah, I totally agree. And in fact, I think the worst thing that's occurred is that the individuals who are hobbyists feel scared to post their observations. Because they get told, oh, well, you didn't breed them, and breeding's where it gets hard, or breeding's where blah, you know, blah, 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 blah. But at the end of the day, sometimes hobbyists have a lot to be able to say, you know, like they might be saying, hey, you know, I've kept snake, like classic example, the Wilma python. I observed, because I put that thing directly on sand, I observed this scooping behavior that's talked about over and over and over. I never thought anything of it. But then you hear breeders who are coming in and saying, well, I only kept them on paper. I didn't realize they would do that on sand. Mm. It's like, you know, that type of observation is only capable, you know, from either a hobbyist or someone like a hobbyist breeder who's got the capacity and is not tied financially to what you're, you know, doing with the animal as much. So I totally agree. I think the concept of you either make it as a breeder or you've done nothing is just completely outdated. And I love seeing the hobby start going the other way, where it's just like, you know, we're going to get a few animals. We're going to keep them really well. I'm going to tell you everything that the animal does, didn't like, did like. And, you know, at the end of the day, the smart breeders, you see this, the smart breeders look at it and say, okay, well, let me see what they said. Because if that might be the difference, you know, if I can feed that thing apple instead of oranges and it's cheaper, then that might be the way to go.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I've said this before on the podcast as well, just a decreased volume of animals gives you a lot more opportunity to observe the animals that you have. And you can't expect somebody with hundreds of animals to be able to observe and watch. It's just not going to happen. I think what I would like to do is, well, first I have a question. As far, you know, there could be some people who just say we should not use the aquarium hobby as an analogy for the reptile hobby. We have no business comparing them. You know, they're totally different. I compare them all the time. I also kept fish. I kept cichlids for a long time. Which was an overlap with my hobby, with my reptile keeping. So I always think, you know, that there's reasons to compare them. Maybe something we'll talk about a little bit later, that I had a guest come on, Rebecca Bentley, who is a fish biologist actually. And she corrected me in thinking, because I often think that the fish hobby is like the pinnacle, and really she's pointing out some, you know, a lot of flaws that we can maybe talk about later. But anyway, I do compare them a lot. Do you think that they should be compared? Like, obviously you do. You wrote the article about it, but what's your thoughts there?
That's a really good point. You know, I don't want to give the impression that the aquarium hobby is doing everything right and the reptile hobby is doing something wrong. You know, every time. It's just not the way. But there are good comparisons, because frankly, the aquaculture, you know, and I don't like using the term aquaculture as well, because that might have a different meaning to some people, but the aquarium hobby is further along. I mean, straight up, I don't know a nicer way to put it. Like, it is further along. You know, when you're looking at things like what individuals now have been able to do with corals. Corals are pretty much, you know, they're maricultured, they're aquacultured. And it's completely, not completely, but let's say 95% removed wild caught corals in the hobby, right? You know, we're talking, and I'm not talking just one species of coral. I'm talking basically universally. Like virtually every, you know, coral you see in a store is going to be aquaculture. Mm-hmm. Now there's less species than when it was wild caught, you know, but that is an example of the hobby being further along, if that's the goal of the, you know, the reptile parts of this. If herpetoculture's goal is to get to a point where we have taken, as Philippe DeVosgely said, from the few, many, you know, mm-hmm. if that's the goal, then why not benchmark yourself against other niche hobbies? And make no mistake about it, this is a niche hobby, you know, and compare to other niche hobbies, like whether that is the aquariums, or again, if it's plants, you know, because there's a lot to be learned from those aspects in terms of one, the business, the industry, the hobby, and two, just the interplay between all of those, you know. And you see it, I think, when people think reptiles, and I'm the same way, because I'm a snake person at heart, we think snakes. But at the end of the day, like, under this herpetoculture blanket, let's say, you've also got things like newts, which would require you to understand the basics that would be able to keep, you know, help you keep an aquarium. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's not as necessarily as much like comparing a, ooh, this is good, this is bad, but it does help to inform, you know, the reptile hobby in a way that I think is very valuable.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, there are two other topics that you covered in the article and in Project Herpetoculture, which were bioactivity and sort of the flaw of using, you know, naturalistic terminology. I think maybe what I'll do is I'll just have people go read the article so they can get your thoughts and your opinions there, and then go listen to episode number 43 of Project Herpetoculture, because there's still a few like real deep things that we want to talk about, and I want to be respectful of your time, and I think people can get that information there. So as long as you're good with that, we can maybe jump into some of the fresh topics.
Sounds good, man.
So one of the really interesting things was the, and this is, I think, a lot draws a lot from the aquarium hobby, is the lack of biofeedback in our reptile enclosures. Can you explain what you mean by that? Hey there, I hope you're really enjoying the episode of the podcast so far. I wanted to take a short break to bring you behind the scenes of the podcast. I want to make this as concise as possible. The podcast has been on for almost 6 years. It's been an absolutely incredible experience for me. I've met many of you, the listeners in person and online, and of course the guests that have brought incredible information to the show. It's been amazing. But I'm now at the point where I really do need this venture to be more economical. To be frank, I need it to make more money. It's just, it really does take up a ton of my time. This is not my full-time job. For those of you that think this is my full-time job, I have a full-time job that requires way more than 40 hours a week. And I squeeze the podcast in amongst family time and other things as much as I can. And I love doing it, but it's now getting to the point where I'm thinking, how long can I continue sacrificing time to this if it's not being economical? And I would love to continue to produce the podcast for absolutely no money, but I think you all understand that that is not really fair to me or my family. So I'm exploring the idea of bringing formal sponsorship onto the podcast, but I'm very reluctant to do so. Of course, I have the affiliate relationship with Custom Reptile Habitats, and I always will. Paul and I get along great. We have the same ethics, the same moral foundation when it comes to herpetoculture. I use his equipment, the Custom Reptile Habitat Maximum Reptile Enclosures, and I love them, and I'm happy to promote them on an affiliate basis. But when I talk about formal sponsors, I'm talking about somebody paying to have me mention their brand at some point in the episode. And I think you can understand why that makes me a little bit uneasy, because it reduces the freedom of the podcast. Maybe I won't have as much freedom to talk about certain things, or now I'm going to have to kind of be careful about what I say about certain products under a certain brand. We all know reptile brands, there's some amazing brands out there, but quite a few of them have some kind of funky products in there that we wouldn't necessarily promote. Would having a formal sponsorship make me not be able to criticize those things? I don't exactly know. So long story short, what I'm asking you as the listener, if you are enjoying the podcast, if you consume it on a regular basis, and you have a disposable $3 or $5 a month that you can sign up for the Patreon, if you go to patreon.com/animalsathome, that would really help. I would really love to continue producing the show funded by the listeners, rather than being funded by a brand. I just feel like that's going to, it could ruin the show in some ways, because the show that you've come to enjoy and the show that I've come to enjoy producing is a completely free and allows me to do whatever I want. As soon as I tie it to a brand in a formal way, like a sponsorship, I'm very worried that it will no longer be the same show. I hope you understand that. So again, it's not about me getting rich off the podcast, but it is about me making sure that the time that I'm using to spend on the podcast is, it makes sense. And it, of course, it takes time from my away from my family and other things. And as much as I love doing the podcast, I mean, think about doing something 10 to 15 hours a week for free for 6 years. I mean, I make a little bit of money right now, but really not enough for it to make sense at this point, as you know, as I evolve in my life. So if you do have an extra couple of bucks and you want to support the podcast that way, that would really go a long way to help secure the podcast's future. If you're enjoying it and you don't want it to stop, you don't want it to stop in the way that it has been, this is the sort of free dialogue without being afraid to talk about products or brands, then signing up for the Patreon is the best way to preserve the Animals at Home podcast as it is today. I think that's all I'm going to say about that. So thank you so much for listening to this. Let's jump back into the episode.
Yeah. So, you know, this is something that I actually what prompted the article and what prompted this section is I remember I recently, probably in the last couple of years, visited Miami Zoo. And, you know, I told you I'm big into the arboreal snakes. Well, they have a great collection of arboreal boas, corallis. So they have, I think, all of the species. I just think that they have at least four that I can think of on display. Every single one of their displays with corallis has dart frogs in it as well. Mm-hmm. Every one of them, you know, and if you told a hobbyist that, they would go crazy because not only that, but it's certain because, like, let's take annulated boas or Russian burger eye, a classic example. Russian burger eye eat frogs in the wild. They'll eat them, you know, so having some species in there that might be, you know, potentially food is something that's just completely foreign in the reptile hobby. So, you know, when discussing biofeedback, what I mean by that is if you have, let's take any type of snake, like a dry marcon, you know, a crebo or an indigo snake, they're going to be the only thing in their terrarium, right? Like, they might have a plant, you might do that, but at the end of the day, that's really what's going to be in there. That animal has zero biofeedback in their space. Like, if you were to take that and contrast it to, like, nature, any area, you know, whether it's a rainforest or even deserts, to a large degree still have some sort of biofeedback. You know, there will be other animals, there will be, whether it's reptiles, invertebrates, birds, you know, and anyone who's been out in the wild will know this. Like, it's uncanny if all of a sudden everything is silent and you don't feel or see anything. Mm-hmm. You know, that part of our brain that says we might be in danger starts getting to you. Or if you see every bird start to flee, you know, in a different direction, or, you know, coming up out of the grass near you, you're that little part of your brain that's been around since the dawn of time is saying, uh-oh, you know, that biofeedback is completely missing in reptile enclosures. Whereas you contrast that with the way that aquarium fish, for the most part, are kept, where generally the basic flow for virtually any aquarium we ever did, and cichlids were the, I would say, are the exception because of the aggression. And we can talk about some biofeedback mechanisms that work with cichlids. But the general flow of virtually every aquarium you see is schooling fish in the center, going back and forth. Then you have some ground dwellers, generally like a Corydoras or some sort of catfish that will eat the food or detritus that gets through the schooling fish. And then you have some algae eaters as well doing their part. Sometimes people use shrimp at this point instead of, like, the Chinese algae eaters or the Plecostomus species. But at the end of the day, what that provides is there's two unique scenarios that I outlined that I think, you know, could be helpful for individuals in the reptile community to understand. The first is what is we call them dither fish. And what they were was you just choose a fish that either was frankly cheap or and hardy, you know, AKA could get beat up if it needed to. But cheap was generally the most important part. And they were used in two different ways. And so going back to, let's say, a little dry marcon, you know, you've got this little snake and it's in a world where everything can eat it. And it has zero ability in whatever enclosure it is to ever know if the giant food monkey's coming. Mm-hmm. Until it feels you stomping on the floor and then you're in front of it, right? Besides you and maybe your other pet, if you have a cat or dog, it has no biofeedback. It's completely alone in a dead silent world. It's not surprising to me that animals like that struggle in larger enclosures. Because at the end of the day, what you would see in the aquariums is if you had a shy fish, so let's say you get a little cichlid who doesn't, you know, or whatever species it is, and you put them in a completely barren enclosure, a lot of time they will never, ever leave whatever hide you give them. They look around, they will peek out and they will go back in. And people don't understand this. These animals, the feeling of security is such a requirement for most of these animals. They will choose the feeling of security until they die from starvation. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense if you think about it, because starvation is a long-term death relatively for these animals. Getting eaten is a short-term death. So if they don't have the ability to deal with that, you know, they don't understand what's around them, there's no biofeedback, then they're just going to sit there and go. So going back to the aquarium hobby, what you could do is if you had a shy fish that was continually hiding, what the best thing you could do for it was to add other fish into the aquarium. And what you do is you choose a species that's also not skittish, because it won't work if they're also skittish. But you know, you get in, let's say, a schooling fish, and you let them swim around. And especially if the schooling fish are conditioned to you, the scared fish looks around and says, okay, well, all of these fish aren't scared of that giant food monkey. He can't be that bad. Oh, now that I'm not scared of the food monkey, he also brings me food. And then you can get them over that cycle, right? Mm. Contrast that with a poor little dry Marcon put in a huge enclosure with nothing. That animal has no ability to understand what's going on around it, you know, and it might even be a better example to think about animals that are more visually oriented even. So like lizards are a classic example. If they're scared and they're going to hide, potential to add in a smaller species that is, I hate to say less valuable, but it is, you know, less valuable, that can kind of create an environment where this animal can see, okay, the, you know, these little ones aren't running from it, you know, the big food monkey anymore. So maybe, just maybe, I can go and not be scared. And, you know, I'm starting to see this concept more and more. Ron St. Pierre just did an episode on Project Herpeticulture, and he's discussing that he keeps a lot of his animals in basically zoo style enclosures where you have multiple animals at multiple levels of the, in the enclosure, you know, very similar to having top schooling fish, middle schooling fish, and bottom dwellers. He's doing a lot of the same things. Or if you look at Roy's setup from Project Herpeticulture, mm-hmm. he keeps a lot of lizards in his setups, you know, even with the snakes. And it makes sense because worst case scenario, like let's say you got a baby dry Marcon and you throw in a bunch of animals and it creates biofeedback, but it also gives that animal a food source. If it decides, okay, I'm never going to come out for the food monkey, I'm scared of it, then they've got a food source in there until they get strong enough or big enough to where they feel confident on their own. And that generally happens. So that's one way that dither fish were generally used in the hobby. The other way, talking about keeping cichlids, is some cichlids, especially Central and South American cichlids, are so violent towards each other in pairs because of the confines of the aquarium that they will beat each other to death. And that's what I used to keep a lot and breed a lot of Central American cichlids. And the problem was, is you couldn't give an aquarium large enough for them to do their natural behavior, which is, you know, female lays eggs. Female defends a central territory, male defends a wider perimeter. But if the male tries to go into the central perimeter, female says he might be trying to eat the eggs and starts trying to attack him. The problem is there's generally such a size advantage for the males that the second they get attacked, they just beat the females to death. And you see it time after time. Or alternatively, female runs male into the glass, into the wall. He bounces back because he's got nowhere to go, runs into the glass until he's dead. So what we would do is we would take large fish that were capable and very fast. So a classic example is silver dollars. Silver dollars were a really good one for this because they're very fast. They're capable of taking a beating and they weren't super expensive. And you throw them in the aquarium. What a lot of times would happen is the pair bond would say, okay, we have an external threat. I can't fight you. We have to fight them, and it will go after the dither fish. And, you know, some species and some pairs, to be honest with you, you keep the dither fish in there all the time. If the dither fish get beat to death, you throw more in there. Others, after getting the pair bond strengthened by the dither fish, you could pull the dither fish or let them die of natural causes over time or unnatural causes if they get beat up. But, you know, either way, you could have them in there. And then once that pair bond strengthened, that pair would be fine forever. But again, there's a certain amount of biofeedback that these animals are used to in the wild, whether it's strengthening pair bonds like that, or just being able to, if they're a little skittish animal, seeing that another animal isn't running for their lives, you know. So we don't have that in the reptile hobby. I think this is a concept that I think we should explore more because it might be the key, in my opinion, to keeping a lot of these very skittish animals, you know, especially wild caught ones, where all of a sudden they've been kidnapped out of, you know, the jungle where there's a ton of biofeedback into an enclosure where they got nothing. And I think experimenting with this could be a really good way to get animals who are, one, skittish to, you know, come out. Two, if they're not eating, maybe the key is just letting them find food on their own time. Or three, if you got an aggressive pair, you throw something else in there that, you know, really they're not going to catch or be able to hurt, then that might be the key to being able to keep pairs of animals that have notoriously been bad about beating each other to death.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's really interesting because there's almost like a psychological difference, I think, between aquarium keepers and reptile keepers on this topic, because I could see people listening to you and go, well, why would I ever add an animal, you know, to that environment to be, you know, beat to death or, you know, type thing, where you're adding it into a stressful environment. But at the same time, you know, we feed frozen rats every day that go through this, you know, experience of being euthanized in order to just keep our animals alive. And if in the end it actually has a net positive experience for the animal that you're trying to raise, you know, because you could go, like when you go buy fish, you go and buy them with the, you know, with the dither fish concept in mind. And I think just that concept, people, you know, you'd have to work to get a reptile keeper to get there. Like, I'm going to go buy, you know, a couple morning geckos and throw them in here and they're going to, you know, act as a dither. But I think that could actually be the next step where people start to think of it that way and go, okay, well, maybe I do have a couple small geckos that, you know, that are on the table to be eaten if need be, or they just are increasing this concept of biofeedback within the enclosure. And I'm okay if some of them, you know, die. It's just part of keeping the species that I'm attempting to keep as the, you know, the main feature.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that's where you start to see the overlap with live food. You know, it's funny you say that about the mice, because that's a point I've said multiple times to people. Reptile keepers are extremely weird about feeding other reptiles to reptiles.
Yeah.
But they will feed a mouse all day, every day to those snakes.
Or a hamster, a gerbil.
Exactly. Like, you see that where the idea of breeding, let's say, feeder snakes for snake eating species is just anathema to most people. But the thing is, the reason we are seeing it now more than previously, I don't think is because of an ethics shift. I think it's because as people get to the outer fringes of what's of species, you start requiring that, you know, and you'll see a lot of people who have started doing it again for the food reasons. Like, if you start bringing in wild caught snake eating snakes, what's your choice? Either throw it a frozen ball python, you know, a deformed one out of the egg, or watch it starve. It might never, ever eat a mouse. You know, and it's like, well, what do you do at that point? You know, so you see it with the food. I agree. I think a lot of people are going to listen to this and be like, wow, I've never thought about just sacrificing a bunch of animals. But at the end of the day, if we're going to do species that, you know, are from these environments that have this biofeedback, or alternatively are animal eaters, then what's the choice? Either don't do the species or you try to do them right. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I know there's going to be ethics concerns, and there should be. But at the end of the day, like I said, we either make a decision to not have these species, or watch, you know, 80% of them starve to death as we get them in, or we make the decision that sometimes you got to just have other ones take one for the team.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think too, I think there's always this lack of willingness to experiment in herpetoculture. And I think part of it is the online culture that we have. Like, if you have one parameter out of whack, you know, you get laid into on Facebook or whatever it is. And I think there's so much we can learn from people just going back to the drawing board and spending time in their reptile room or their basement, wherever it is, and tinkering with things and learning. So in many ways, I think if anybody wants to try this, they should just document everything they do, but they don't necessarily need to take the internet on the ride until they come up to a relatively well thought out conclusion. Maybe after a year of trying something, like, you know, like you said, adding some dart frogs into a snake enclosure or whatever it is. Roy's doing a great job of it. There's lots of people that are doing mixed species enclosures that don't end in an animal getting beaten to death or eaten, but I think it's worth people trying different things to see what happens, and maybe they do act as a food source, or however it ends up. But I think trying to say I'm going to do this and then putting it on Facebook as a proposal for an experiment is just, you know, that's why these things just go up in flames, because the most people just don't have a tolerance for it.
Agreed. And, you know, the reptile hobby has two sides of the same coin that have basically stifled all innovation. You've got the lowest common denominator on these social media sites who will say, I can't believe you're going to do this. You're the dumbest person alive, right? And then on the other side of the coin, you've got people, let's say Roy, you know, spends the next 5 years doing it. He writes every single thing down, you know, or someone else, let's not even use him as an example. Let's just say someone does this and spends 5 years doing this. They post it on social media. You know what the other side's going to say? Oh, well, actually, it wasn't done under laboratory conditions and wasn't done by, you know, a peer-reviewed study. So that means this information's worthless. You know, so you see both sides of it in the reptile community. And it's just, it's created an environment where people are scared either way. Like, they do provide information, and then they get told, oh, well, sorry, you did it with a sample size of 35. And if it's not 100, it doesn't count. Like, you know, you see that constantly. And so I see both sides of it. I'm like, none of this stuff in the aquarium hobby really came from science. Like, you know, in terms of keeping, they just did it. They've been doing it so long that, like, the concept of Western concept of science never existed. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like, you know, when Asian cultures had started keeping goldfish in bowls, or, you know, started breeding, koi out of carp, that all of a sudden they were, you know, saying, oh, well, actually, we need to do it under these scientific methods that didn't exist. Yeah. So sometimes it just has to be innovation, and it has to be innovation for innovation's sake. You know, you can say it that way, but needing a scientific purpose or needing the approval of 5,000 people on Facebook is just, it's created a problem where no one wants to experiment at all.
Oh, yeah, it's totally. I mean, the creativity and innovation happens before the white paper. You know, that's why how someone comes up with an experiment, an idea for a study, because you have to be creative and think of different things to test. So I find it hilarious when people say, well, where's the peer-reviewed paper to show that exists? So it's like, well, maybe it doesn't exist yet, but the peer-reviewed paper doesn't change the science. It just highlights something that already exists, and you need people who are willing to sit down and observe to see whether or not, you know, how the science will lay out in the end. This kind of leads us into the sort of the hunting and the food aspect of the paper that you had written. And I think there's some really interesting things here. And this kind of, I think, continues the thread of the ethics and how we, you know, expand and contract our view of keeping animals in captivity. Can you walk people through the utilization of hunting that stimulates breeding behavior in some fish?
Yeah, so this is one of those topics that it was really surprising to me that hasn't been discussed. So when you're dealing with freshwater, we'll stick with freshwater aquarium fish for this. It doesn't matter the size. If we're talking the largest cichlid you can think of in the hobby, you know, we're talking peacock bass 30 inches long or 1 inch long, you know, betta species. Generally, especially in the closer they are to wild caught, the more this applies. So F0, F1, F2, and in some species all the way down the chain, they almost always respond better to live foods, even if it's the same food source. And what I mean by that is if you were to feed them black worms that were live versus frozen and then thawed out black worms, they will respond differently. And when you're breeding animals, or what they call conditioning for breeding, generally, and especially with any of the new species, the protocol is to feed them live food and feed them as much as they want. And, you know, there is an argument to be made that there is some sort of nutritional difference or taste difference that occurs, you know, when you're talking frozen thawed or when you're talking just live. So I won't discount that. And you know, that's possible. That's part of it. But what it really seems to be is that the animals respond to the hunting behavior. You know, like there's a big difference between a fish going up and grabbing a freeze-dried or frozen thawed, you know, bloodworm versus having to go to the bottom and fight this wriggling mass and over and over and over. And what you see is, especially in female fish, that generally the live food thing. So like, again, the same food source fed, you know, frozen thawed or live, you see a response by especially females where they will start producing eggs if they're getting live food. And so a lot of the hobbyists, you know, hobbyist breeders in this point, just don't even use frozen food. They will just continually have live food as a source for all of these animals because it stimulates breeding behavior. I would say from my experience that it seems to be it's the actual act of hunting, you know, where the animal has to think, it has to use. It also is a trigger that makes sense if you think about it in the wild. You know, a lot of these animals come from environments where it's boom, bust, feast, famine. And so one of the signals for the little tiny fish brains might be, hey, we're now seeing all of these wriggling masses. There's a ton of live food that we're eating. That signal to them says, okay, now I can reproduce because I know my offspring will be eating the offspring that are here now from these invertebrates. And I think that is something that's missing in the reptile hobby. I think especially when it comes to snakes, because the danger is real, and I will not discount this. The danger is real of feeding live food to snakes. You know, when it comes up, a large rat can do serious damage. But the fact is we have eliminated hunting behavior from snakes for in effectively all instances. You know, slapping it in the face with a frozen thawed rat or just dangling in front is not the same as having that snake run it down in a burrow. It's just not. And part of me wonders if some of these species, one of the triggers for breeding is in fact hunting behavior. It's not the eating that does it, you know, because a lot of people do and have been successful food cycling, but there are species that just don't seem to respond well to food cycling, you know, or don't respond as strongly. And then people will generally default to either food cycling or temperature cycling or a combination of both. But it's very possible that some of these species, especially again, because we're getting to the outer fringes, right? Like the species we're able to breed consistently is getting larger and larger. So you end up with these outer fringe animals that just might, we might see that the hunting behavior is a trigger. I think of this with Bolin's pythons. People have tried, they're getting better, and consistent. And I've never kept a species, so I'm just spitballing. But, at the end of the day, it's very possible that one of the triggers for them is their nest raiders. And this is known, they're known nest raiders. But if you remove that nest raiding behavior and you just feed them a bunch of food, you might have some success if, let's say, three of the five other triggers are hit. But what if that's the one that would make it most consistent? So that was kind of my idea behind discussing this is, if we can add another trigger for a lot of these animals to our arsenal, we might be able to work with species that we've generally had low or no success with.
Yeah. Well, you think about even for us as human beings, physical activity obviously is a trigger for health, and hormetically, there's a bunch of things that happen, and that's sort of what happens when an animal has to hunt or take down a wild prey item. Is there's going to be a level of exertion and muscular fatigue and all these things that do cause absolutely a cascade of hormones changes throughout the body, and those could be part of the triggers as well. So it is a really fascinating concept, and again, it's something that's been so taboo to discuss. Because we talk about the ethics of an animal dying in that way, and then B, the ethics of putting the snake in danger if you are feeding rodents, and that's why a lot of people move to keeping lizards, because they get to, it's an easy way to stimulate hunting behavior because you're feeding insects, and even people now keeping insectivorous snakes, same thing. No, you're not feeding dead crickets or dead worms to an insectivorous snake. You're actually allowing them to hunt and carry out exactly as they would in the wild. So it is a challenge when you're eating or when you're feeding snakes that eat birds, lizards, or mammals, to stimulate that hunting behavior in a safe way. It's kind of a trick. It's sort of a rock and a hard place for many people.
Yeah, exactly. And, it's funny you bring up humans. I think the reason that we see the reptile hobby do what we do in terms of food is a lot of based on what you said. Classic example is everyone who's been in the reptile hobby long enough understands obese animals really don't breed well. Mm-hmm. It's across the board. Obese fish don't breed well. It's interesting that the way that people deal with obese animals is to just stop feeding them as much. However, on the other hand, you could keep feeding them more than they would get in the wild if they got a corresponding higher level of activity.
Yes.
There's a default away from increasing activity. Generally, and I don't know this for sure, but I would speculate that it's probably because people don't want to provide them with an enclosure that allows them to do that all the time. Again, because sometimes economy of scale, but it's just like humans, you can eat 4,000 calories if you work out twice a day. You don't have to reduce caloric intake to maintain a healthy weight, right? And so, again, we just, as a hobby, we have kind of taken some things for granted, like increasing activity instead of decreasing food to maintain the proper muscular mass on some of these animals. And like you said, I think the lizard portion of herpetoculture doesn't seem to have this much of an issue, and it might truly be because these animals have to hunt over and over and over. I think somehow, somewhere along the way, snakes have been divorced from lizard care in a way that just does not make sense based on their biology. People have said, oh, snakes, that means they can go in this dark area, no stimulation, and they're totally fine, whereas this lizard has to have UVB, it has to have all this stuff. And it's like, I think snakes in a way have become victims of their own success. They're so successful as a body plan, as a type, as in, a group, that people can do just what would just be the bare minimum and still have what I would call minimal to large success.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what people kind of do with that information. As you say, there's a lot of animals that don't need to be hunting is a great form of enrichment, but if you're not planning on breeding and the animal that you are working with isn't struggling with breeding, maybe it's not worth the risk of feeding a live rat, for example, because there's always that the catch 22 as far as what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do. But if you are someone that's needing that extra potential stimulation to create a breeding activity, then maybe it's something that we ought to do more of, and maybe there are ways to do it in a fashion that doesn't cause danger to the animal. And maybe animals are pretty good at killing other animals, so it is quite a quick death. I mean, it's always the jury's kind of always out at how ethical and peaceful it is to die through asphyxiation from a CO2 overdose, right? So who knows if that's even good for the animal either.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously I'm not advocating torturing any animal, but the fact is if you keep any sort of reptile, they're eating something else. I think you're right in that the ethics of the hobby have gotten away from the idea that, look, if you keep it, that means you are effectively directly responsible for killing however many mice that thing eats over the course of its life. It's just a fact. You don't like that. You know, the plant hobby's always there. You know, it just is what it is. So, you know, I definitely think you're right on that, and we'll see what the future holds. And I think I've heard Roy mention kind of a nice middle ground where he's doing enrichment behaviors with food, like hunting behaviors, but with whether it doesn't have to be with live, right? You could do thawed out chicks, put in a container that mimics a nest, and then put somewhere in the enclosure, right? Like those animals are going to be able to hunt that stuff down. They're going to get the benefits of moving. They're going to get the benefits of having to quote unquote think to eat, but not necessarily be in danger themselves. Again, that doesn't solve the problem of the fact that you had to kill X number of, you know, chickens or quail or rats to, you know, feed the animal. But at the end of the day, that does prevent damage to the animals or the species that we are focusing on for the hobby.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You can do all sorts of things, puzzle feeders, you know, scent trails. Like there's lots of options there to sort of at least get close to mimicking that hunting behavior. Why don't we discuss the framework for breeding new species that you kind of outline? As I think this is a real key, and I think it also relates to the original, the tigerfish story at the beginning, as far as, you know, making sure that we're not letting some species slip through our fingers and understanding that we don't want to be using the wild as our picking ground for our pets. So, you know, you kind of use the framework that the aquarium hobby uses that we could potentially transfer over to our side of things.
Yeah. And I will preface this by saying it seems that in herpetoculture, there are breeders who have figured out that frameworks make the most sense. And because of the proliferation of podcasts, you're seeing more of this information get out. I think there's definitely a trend towards understanding that creating a systematic framework will add value it continues to grow in the hobby. So basically what I did in this part of the article is I wanted to discuss how when a new fish is brought into the hobby, and again, we'll just keep it to freshwater fish, tropical freshwater fish, because they make up a vast, vast majority of the hobby. I know people, it's starting to turn. You'll see more saltwater aquariums now because the equipment's gotten much better. But the most part, what you do is say someone goes and does a search and finds a new betta species out of Southeast Asia. They're not going to start from scratch with those. They're not going to look at it and say, well, it's species X. What they're going to do is say, okay, well, species A through Y have already, you know, betta species have already been bred in the hobby. And what they do is they'll take it and they'll say, okay, if it's an Amazonian species or species that has some sort of cyclical rain, what you do is you generally would take your aquarium, you would slowly let the water evaporate. And you have to be careful with this because as water evaporates, all the negative, like the nitrates, nitrites, and ammonia actually stay in the water because the water evaporates. It's just the water itself. But you slowly increase the temperature. And depending on where the species is from, you increase a little more, a little less, you know. But over the course of anywhere from a few days to a few weeks, you let the water level drop and you slowly increase the temperature, which would mimic, if you think about it, the water level, let's say in the Amazon or in Southeast Asia, dropping. And what water is left is warming up, right? And then all of these areas receive a deluge of rain, you know, just, and it's going to be a little cooler than the water. And so what you would do is then you, as this is going on, you're trying to condition the fish, normally again with live food, and then you just hit them with a little bit cooler water, fill the aquarium back up, and just feed it six times a day if you want. You know, just keep feeding them to the point where they're, you know, about to explode almost. And what that does is it generally, that what I just described will work for literally hundreds of tropical species. You know, and as they get further in the aquarium hobby, you know, from F0 to F1 to F2, generally you can eliminate that middle step where you're actually making the aquarium warm up and then cool down. You can just do a large water change and then feed them real heavily and they'll breed. But that framework is consistently used. It's been discussed in in aquarium books for 40 years, right? It's what every time you ever see any of these articles, a great publication called Amazonas does a lot of new, you know, species breeding articles. They always do the same thing. They start with this. If that doesn't work, they make note of it. And what that is important, that's just as important as it working, right? Because if you say, here's the framework, and it doesn't work, then maybe this species requires a little something extra. I would love to see this in herpetoculture more. You know, I think some very successful breeders, and I can think of a few of the snake breeders like Ryan Young or Nick Mutton, who have, or Vin Russo with boas, you know, they talk about this. They use this approach across even whether it's genus or multiple genera, you know, so like not just sticking with pythons, but also with boas. They will use a framework like this to establish the species that work with them, especially if it's new species to them or a new species in the hobby. But I would like to see this become much more structured. I would like to see, you know, people who come into the hobby who want to breed for the first time be able to go to a website and say, here's the framework, right? If I have the species, I want it to, this is the framework. And then if there's some sort of nuance, the communities, again, maybe it's small batch or hobbyist breeders, say, here's the nuance with these species. It might be something as simple, like they want live food, or instead of being able to, you know, get them down to 70, they actually have a point where they need to be 55. You know, so just creating a process by which new species can be worked with, I think would be extremely valuable. And not just a one breeder doing this. I'm talking across the board, everyone contributing their experience and creating a structural framework that could potentially be the key to unlocking a lot of these, you know, species. But if it's just in someone's head, you know, in one spot and it's never published or never understood, then, you know, what's the value of it for herpetoculture long term? There's basically none.
Yeah, I wonder why our community becomes very like islands almost, where somebody's doing a project and it doesn't, it's not like people aren't willing to share necessarily. It's just for whatever reason, there's no cohesiveness when we're doing this sort of thing. I don't know why it's different for the aquarium hobby.
Cultural acceptance is what I would say. And I think this is the general default answer, I think, for most people would assume is money. You know, it's, hey, I figured it out. I'm going to try to do it. But this predates money in the hobby. You know, I saw this. I think it's cultural acceptance. And I'll explain a little more. So going back to the fact that I had been going to Daytona and Orlando since I was a little kid, I grew up with it. I remember those days, like being into reptiles during the late 90s, early 2000s was not like cool. You know, I can only speak for the United States, but that wasn't something you told people, right? Like you kind of had to keep it to yourself, especially like down here in Florida, people don't want to talk about what they have because they're afraid eventually it's going to be made illegal. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case and they've got pictures of all of it on, you know, the Instagram, then you got a problem. So I think there was a lack of cultural acceptance of herpetoculture in general, which prevents people from wanting to open up at all. And then, you know, as we've become a community and it's become more accepted, the old keepers, where people who have done this for a long time, still remember the days where, like, you know, if you had said, yeah, I'm feeding brained pinkies to my Arizona mountain king snakes, people would look at you like you had just said you would, you know, kick their dog across the room. You know, nowadays it's, you know, we're all in the hobby, so we understand that. But at the end of the day, like, cultural acceptance, I think, is what prevented it at first. And I think there's some legacies of that. Now, with some of the newer individuals, you do have to wonder if it's just money. Mm-hmm. It's whether, hey, I don't want to teach X, Y, and Z how to do a species that I spent this much time getting up and running. You know, I hate to say that, but I don't think that was the initial reason. I think the initial reason was that the entire herpetoculture field was just considered like a fringe. And because of that, no one wanted to talk about it at all. Mm.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And that actually made, just listening to you talk there, made me think of another great point that you made in the article. And you kind of told a little story from the fish world experience, was, you know, almost highlighting the fact that breeders should feel an obligation to make sure that the animals that they're breeding will make good pets and be able to survive in the pet environment. And the story you tell is getting fish from large professional breeders that have been, you know, basically swimming in an antibiotic soup their entire life, and they're not thriving. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's a a topic that I think, again, just the T.C. Houston episode kind of can touch on, because what you see is, again, when you're talking about professional breeders, you're talking about individuals who have to do the economy of scale. And what that means is it's not necessarily cutting corners or like torturing the animals, but it does mean that it's bare bones. And some of the professional breeders, at least back in the day, would do things like add antibiotics prophylactically to the water. You know, like they would basically just keep the animals in, like you said, an antibiotic suit, because what it did is it prevented deaths. But then once you got them to a standard aquarium where the antibiotics are taken from them, they would just die over and over. There was no thought as to what the end care was going to look like. And so I think breeders, in whether it's hobbyist breeders or professional breeders, do have a responsibility to sell animals that are going to be kept in a way, or that are adapted to what they know will be the end keeper's care. And that doesn't mean that these breeders have to, you know, I don't mean hobbyists doing the wrong thing. You know, if they're keeping their corn snake at 20 degrees Fahrenheit, like there's nothing you could prepare that poor animal for. It's just, there's nothing. But generally what you see is, we all know that, like, in our hobby, if someone goes to this reptile, you know, a pet store, they're not going to go buy a rack for their ball python. They don't sell racks at all of these big box stores. What they sell are terrariums, heat lamps. You know, they're going to put them on whatever substrate. And again, you know, that's not saying the animal put in the wrong position should be, you know, made that way. But at the end of the day, these breeders need to make animals that are at least partially adapted to the environments that they know the end hobbyist is going to is keep them in. So yeah, exactly. When we're talking about the aquarium hobby, it was really evident, because what we would do is we get these animals in, and certain big breeders, we get their animals in, and within 3 weeks, all of them are dead. And it's like, you can't, eventually you ask enough questions and you start to understand the issue is these animals were completely unprepared. They're the classic boy in a bubble. Yeah, and you see that a lot with snakes. If you've got an animal that's been kept in the most sterile conditions in the world, green tree pythons are kept this way. They've got a 3D printed plastic perch in a tub with paper towels in the bottom or a puppy pad. That animal, it's no wonder they would fail. If you put them in an environment where all of a sudden they've got the microbes from the soil, they've got, you know, just whether the food source changes a little bit, or, you know, whether there's some sort of invertebrate life, you know, it's not surprising that these animals start to even just get sick from getting stressed from being in something they're not used to. But at the end of the day, if a green tree python breeder knows that the way that people are going to keep them is different than the way that they are, then maybe they need to incorporate those methods too, because and I say this in the article, it defies logic to believe that these green tree pythons in the hobby cannot live in something that's closer to what they live in the wild. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't make sense. Like, you know, they'd be saying, that's the equivalent of saying lab rats can only live in lab rat conditions. Yeah. It's illogical. It doesn't work. On the other hand, and I mentioned this, hobbyists to me have two choices where they are with the way that they keep that I think makes them not liable for what happens with the animal to a large degree. And that's either you keep it exactly like the breeder did, or you keep it based on its natural history. If you don't do those two and you keep it a third way, you either have to know that you're experimenting with that animal and you're risking its life, or it's all completely on you, right? Like, you can't go in and say, I'm going to take this desert species, I'm going to put it in my rainforest vivarium and expect it to do well. And the breeder's been keeping it in a rack. And when you go online, you realize, no, the thing needs a rock, you know, a bunch of rocks, a really hot spot, and sand, you know, again. So there's going to be not necessarily blame, but there needs to be an understanding, I think, across herpetoculture in terms of what care should look like. On the other hand, another point with this is we can't expect breeders to start keeping animals in this way and not charge an upcharge. Mm-hmm. Because if you're gonna put every one of them in a larger enclosure, even if it's just having substrate where they didn't have substrate before, that is an additional cost that's going to be baked into the animal. The only people who can kind of get away with that is, you know, without having to think so much about it, would be the hobbyist breeder or small batch breeder. But again, their animals are going to reflect the value of what's been put into them, and that's completely fair. It's not fair to expect, you know, a professional breeder to do all of this and then keep their $99, you know, $95 price on whatever it is. So
yeah. I think that's really well said. I mean, I think the concept of immune system shock is something that we never think about, and that's really, really probably a very likely hypothesis when you're talking about an animal that's in a completely sterile environment. And actually, the episode that I posted last week was with a lady that works in a store, and they're doing some breeding, and she talked about with the tubs with the babies, one thing that she does is she incorporates just things that she knows will be in the pet type setup. So whether that's cork or wood or leaf litter, you're not decking out these things like crazy, but you're just taking small bits of material. We know how good snakes' memories are, reptiles' memories are, and how sensory driven they are. So if you give them the opportunity to smell and feel cork when they get into the environment of their pet home with cork background, for example, it doesn't seem like a totally foreign material, something that they've been used to before. So there are definitely ways to do this without having, you know, massive enclosures at the, you know, like you said, economies of scale becomes a problem, but there's a middle ground.
Yeah, 100% agree. And I'd come at it from the immune system shock aspect, because I think that won't be talked about as much unless you've seen it with animals. But you know, there is the other aspect where some of these snakes, or, you know, lizards, whatever, frogs especially, actually, you could take them the most, they're going to have the immune system shock, but also they just do not deal well with their environment being different than what they grew up in. You know, yeah. I mean, it's just like they overstimulate and they get sick. And a lot of these species, and you see it with fish too, there are certain species, if they're sick, they're dead. You know, because a lot of these reptiles especially seem to have an ability to basically show no sickness until they're on death's door. Yeah. And, you know, and that's kind of just the case. So, yeah, I definitely agree. I think that getting a situation where either the stores that we get them from or the breeders that we get them from have started kind of incorporating aspects that they know will be in the innkeeper's care will be really helpful for a lot of reasons. Again, immune shock is one. The other is just straight up overstimulation / stress response. So yeah, I definitely love to see that. I think it's, but it seems that the hobby is going that way. You know, we're seeing more and more of that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and one other layer to add on top of the immune system issue is, and this is probably only something that's really related to people who are working with morphs, but the more inbreeding that you do, the weaker immune systems typically become. So you could be dealing with an animal that genetically has a horrible immune system to begin with. And if you're keeping it in a sterile environment, then it's just sort of a recipe for disaster. So I think that's a really, at least to start the conversation, to have people start thinking about that, you know, we talk about having a bioactive substrate, and you know that essentially means microbes, and there are other things living in the enclosure. So you have to understand that the animal that you put into that enclosure is now forced to interact with those things, which is normally not a bad thing. We always interact with microbes on a daily basis, but if you have absolutely zero immune system, it's going to be a big problem. Why don't we wrap up discussion with technology? Because that was something else that you had said to me, I think outside the article, you had mentioned that. And we're actually starting to see this in the reptile hobby now, you know, technology advancing, and which is really cool. There's even though it is niche, the hobby itself or herpetoculture is growing to the point where we can start playing around with new tech. But something that you had said to me, which I thought was interesting, was that in some cases, the older aquarium technology is actually better than what we're seeing today. So what does that mean?
Yeah, technology is really interesting. And I love the prefaces. I love what the Luminize system looks to be doing. I haven't used them yet, but just the idea, and you know, it's classic reptile herpetoculture thing where this new product comes out and everyone says, well, they've been doing it for 20 years in the aquarium hobby. No, there has never been, you know, when it comes to the UV part, you've never had a UV bulb at that level for these animals that has been dimmable that I know of, you know, and the aquarium hobby has nothing similar. Now, as far as the LED goes, yes. So technology is an interesting topic when it comes to the herpetoculture and aquariums, because what you saw and what I think a lot of people don't understand, and going back to the LEDs with aquariums, is LEDs were not brought into the aquarium hobby because they're better than the metal halides we were using on saltwater. They just weren't. People think they were because everyone thinks, well, you know, a classic example is if you compare it to something like an iPhone, iPhone 10 is better than iPhone 1. That's how technology works to most people. You know, that's not how this actually is when you're dealing with different types of technology. So for the aquarium hobby, when I got into it for saltwater aquariums, there was two types. There's mercury vapor bulbs, or there was metal halides. Halides, people pronounce it different. But those grew every coral under the sun. They would grow tridacna clams, which were extremely hard to grow. You know, they were effectively the closest people could get to mimicking the sun. They worked exceptionally well. They grew everything. I never saw something that couldn't grow in the right environment. Like, what I mean by that is, when you're dealing with light penetrating water, you have a certain amount before the parts of the light that the corals would utilize actually start to fade. So they have to be within a band, you know, or shorter aquariums are bringing the light down. But those lights have been around for 25 years. I've seen hobbyists that get into aquariums now, who I've talked to, that have said like, oh, well, you know, why would I do that when I can do an LED? LEDs work better. That's not true. LEDs do not grow corals better. It's just, I've seen them, they just don't. But what LEDs did is LEDs do not require the bulbs that metal halides do, and they last longer. So a metal halide bulb, to be frank, 6 to 9 months and you're replacing it. They're extremely hot, and they were like $70 a bulb, American, you know, back then. So what occurred was, is LEDs, or and in between there were compact fluorescent bulbs, T5 high output, which you still see in the reptile industry a lot more. Those were brought in as a cheaper, more economical way to try to mimic what the halides were doing. They did not work as effectively. LEDs, the first round of LEDs that were coming to the aquarium hobby, were a disaster. I remember using them. They couldn't control, again, because as light penetrates water, you know, we're seeing a drop off. But LEDs don't actually have that drop off as much. So what people were doing is they put them on their aquariums, and it would melt every coral on the bottom. Because generally the way that you would do it is you would do lower light corals in the bottom, higher light corals up top, but it would melt all these bottom ones because they were getting too much light, you know, in a different spectrum, in a different way. So that was one issue. The other issue is the spectrums were wrong on a lot of these. And this was like a problem for about 4 or 5 years. And so what you'd see in aquariums is massive algae blooms. Because if there's that much light energy in an aquarium, but it's not getting absorbed by animals that you want, algae is going to grow. So you would see that. What people started doing was starving their aquariums of nutrients to try to prevent that. So you had a situation where the light was potentially the problem, but they would starve the nutrients. It went so far as people realized, wait a minute, we are starving the aquarium of so much nutrients that our corals can't grow any longer. So we're having to add more food to make up for it. So you'll see that a lot in the hobby. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that that fine balance is right there, because if anything veers off, you're getting algae. So that's a classic example where the technology that was used 30 years ago is just as good or better than the one now in some aspects, but it's not as economical. Mm-hmm. I think we're seeing that with the reptile and herpetoculture hobby as well, where you're seeing more and more people are saying, wait a minute, like an aquarium works just as fine. You know, an old aquarium worked fine for this, you know, even though they were phased out. Now, some technology like hot rocks needed to go, but it doesn't always mean, you know, that every piece of technology that comes out is an improvement upon the ones before. It might just be that it has a different application. You know, so like the luminized thing, I actually think is very interesting because it feels like a flat out improvement, you know, where you're just taking an existing technology and you're modifying in a way that will help the animals without trying to say like, oh, we've created this new thing and, you know, it's going to do, it's just the most amazing thing in the world. You know, so I think you see a lot of that where the technology aspect is going to continue to grow, and I hope it does. But at the end of the day, people don't need to lose sight of what worked just as effectively 30 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point, because I think especially for anyone that's been born, you know, in the early 80s till now, we'll say we've been all exposed to this insane technological advance through our childhoods and through our early adulthood. Mm-hmm. And it always does, you know, has the at least the implication that this generation is better than last generation, whatever it is. And it just, you know, continues to go that way. But like you said, it's not always the case. And we actually saw that in the reptile world as well when UV LEDs came in. You know, there are still some brands that are working with them, and I won't disparage any brand, but there was this assumption that because there's UV LEDs, they must be better than the T5s, and that just wasn't the case. And now hopefully one day that is the case, because they are more efficient and you can be much more fine-tuned and it's easier. But for now, the T5 is still the way to go. And it can be confusing to people to see a brand new product that just jump out and get it and assume that, you know, the welfare has increased for their animal. Not necessarily the case.
Hell yeah. I mean, they're thinking, okay, I had an iPhone 3 and I got an iPhone 4. And that's just, like you said, it's not the way it is. Like, what is the purpose of the technology. The purpose of LEDs was to remove, like for our hobbies, you know, talking about aquariums and reptiles, the purpose of LED is to have a longer lasting bulb with less heat. It's that simple. It wasn't about the spectrum or whatever. So, you know, when you're dealing with animals that actively absorb UV or you have to be, that has to be the main concern, not heat, not expense, you know? And I think I read a lot of these books from Europe and the edition Camaros, and they actually, a lot of these keepers over there in those books, it's mercury. They call, you know, they use different terminology, but they're basically mercury vapor bulbs or metal halides. They're still using them over there for things like monitors because they do such a good job of mimicking the sun. Yes, they're completely inefficient. Like I remember running one 400 watt would be like $30 to $40 a month to your power bill. So so I mean, no one wants to run them, but at the end of the day, if we're going to keep these animals, don't think that that technology is worse than the one you've got now, or think the one that you have now is better just because it's new. It's not. You need to do some critical analysis.
And now one other thing that Rebecca had told me, this is Rebecca Bentley, a guest I've had on the past. She's again, like I said at the beginning, she's a fish biologist, and she had mentioned that one of the technology booms, I guess you can call, in the marine hobby is you start seeing so much automation that she's saying you're starting to see people that actually don't understand how to troubleshoot and don't understand how to balance water and create an aquarium, because everything is to the point technologically where you can, everything's plug and play, and now you have someone that barely can understand the concept of what they're doing but can get by on the skin of their teeth just by the technology. Do you see that as well? Or
yeah, man. I mean, we used to see it all the time. It used to drive people crazy because, if I worked at a place that had endorsed this, we would have made money hand over fist. People would come in and they would say, my water, I'm having a water quality issue with X. And I looked online and it says, I need a new protein skimmer or I need some other piece of technology. And you know what? I would look at them and say, just do a water change. It fixes every problem that you're discussing. Just it needs new water and it needs old water taken, you know, and you're right. Like there is a point where technology, we become too reliant on technology. You know, it's a fine balance. Like I'd like to see the herpeticulture start embracing, like let's say Miss King systems or whatever brand, Misters. I think that has been lacking when it comes to lizards and snakes, even though it's in the frogs. So I'd like to see more of that. On the other hand though, if you're just constantly got the Miss King running, you might think, okay, I'm set. You know, like a new keeper might say, I got the Miss King. What do you mean my animal's not drinking water? What do you mean my animal's dehydrated? They have no ability to think my animal might be dehydrated based on whatever they see, because in their head, that's checked off the box, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what Rebecca's discussing, is you got a situation where it becomes like a, well, I bought the thing. So why isn't the thing doing what the thing's supposed to do? And sometimes the things just don't work, you know, or they work too well. Again, like protein skimming and filtration got so good on these marine aquariums that people are actually having to add in nutrients because they'll starve out their corals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And one of the things she had mentioned and you had kind of alluded to earlier is this progression into, and we see this in reptile keeping, into the predator fish and the large fish. And, you know, you see a lot of old school aquarium keepers who are kind of begging people to stop buying fish that just do not do well in aquariums. And we see that all the time in our hobby as well, in reptile keeping, people buying animals that really, unless you have an incredibly specialized setup or a lot of space or whatever, it's just not going to work. And so those kind of run tangent or, you know, parallel to each other as far as people just taking that progression into species that we probably shouldn't even be keeping in captivity, at least in the private home.
All right. I'll drop the hot take because I feel, you know, strong on this one. You know, I told you before we hopped on that I have worked in a professional capacity with some of the agencies in Florida, including FWC. And these agencies are doing what they think they need to do to prevent people from keeping animals that maybe you shouldn't keep. Like your reticulated pythons are a classic example. We're talking about an enormous animal. Absolutely enormous in the wild. I mean, yeah, people, the ones in the hobby are fat and slow, but even if you slimmed it down and made it strong, we're talking a huge animal. And they're not necessarily just terrestrial. They seem to be, from everything I've read, they're basically arboreal or semi-arboreal, right? I think the greatest existential threat to this hobby is not escaped animals. It's these animal rights organizations realizing the way to attack this is not to say reticulated python equals scary anymore, because there are enough people that have exposure to reptiles as the as herpetoculture's grown and the industry's grown to where that's become ineffective. It's like, well, you're scared of the snake. Like, you see less and less people who are scared of snakes. The more effective route for these organizations, and I think this will inevitably occur, and I'll pick on the reticulated python people for a little bit, is they're going to look and say the opposite. They're going to say, yeah, you like snakes. We all like snakes. They're actually not scary, and they've gotten maligned for 200 years. Look at how they're keeping these things. Mm-hmm. That's going to be the thing, regardless of whether optically, whether that animal is actually breeding. You can't go and, people say, well, yeah, but they're breeding in the 6x2. Do you think people who don't understand what breeding these animals is like care about that? They're going to say, you got a 14-foot long snake in a 6x2. It can't move. Its nose is rubbing off. You're going to have a problem where individuals in this hobby don't see what's going to occur. And that's what's going to occur. The shift has already started. People aren't scared of snakes as much anymore. So that's a worthless argument. The strong argument is the opposite. It's you go to Congress and you say, look at what these people are doing to these poor animals. Yeah, we think snakes are good too. We think they're like their dogs and cats. We believe them when they say, this animal means as much to me as my dog. But look at how they keep these animals that they claim they like as much as their dog. So again, I think we're going to see more and more issues with that. I agree with her. The aquarium hobby had that. And frankly, there was less regulation on big fish than there are big snakes. Big snakes in Florida are hard to get. Big fish are not. Like a pacu, a classic example, those fish get enormous. We're talking big enough to eat for sure. It's big, yeah. 3 feet long. They're huge. They're fat, thick. I was lucky that the store I worked at had a rule. We didn't sell anything that got that big. They just made a decision. The average person is going to want to buy that, and they cannot take care of it. So growing up, that was hugely influential to me. So it was interesting when I got into reptiles, and I remember the days before the Burmese python ban, and it was like, you could go to a reptile show and get an animal that's not only is it going to get 14 feet long, but the difference is pacus in the wild eat like fruit. Reticulated pythons are huge, and they are predators. They are like an apex predator in their environment. So, it's wild to me that we can go and just purchase an apex predator and then keep it in a way that, eventually, again, I think that is going to be the argument moving forward. If I was going to craft an argument to these agencies to ban these animals, it wouldn't be big snake equals scary. It would be big snake equals dog and cat to these people, and they're torturing their dog and cat. Yeah. Whether that's true or not, that's going to be the narrative.
That is, I can see that you're a good lawyer. I can see how it's so true. I mean, and in some ways it's like we almost are digging our own grave because, and I'm not saying we shouldn't do this, but we're exposing the public, teaching people that they are not as scary as you think. And we're building up all this work in order for them to play the Uno reverse card, and all that work that we did just completely reverses. And it's so true. Like, how can you go from saying they're not scary and they're our pets, they're basically our puppy dogs, but then also have them in a condition that any AR group will use as pure ammunition?
Yeah. And I mean, and that's not to say everyone's doing this. And I think getting the people at, to the forefront who are keeping these animals in a way that is going to be appealing to people who do not understand is really helpful. Because take, for example, the enclosures behind you. People might not like snakes, but if they look at that enclosure, they're going to say, well, how are you going to argue that's not taking care of the animal's needs, right? It looks beautiful. You can tell people about it. You can explain that you have everything met. It's a very different and feel for it, and that's much harder to go about. But again, I think the easy sell, once you get enough people accustomed to this, is just saying, yeah, they are their dogs and cats, and they're just mistreating them, because all these other animals, they can take from you. People can get their dogs and cats taken. It's harder, but you can get your dog and cat taken if you're mistreating them. And society has determined, yes, it's probably not as stringent as we'd like, but society has determined rules that people can do with their animals. That's just a fact. I can't dangle my cat out the window. I'm not saying I would, but you know what I mean? That's the type of stuff that would get people called, because we've decided that once snakes are brought into the mainstream, we run into the issue where there's going to be mainstream expectations for them. And I'm not certain that the hobby has thought that through. I think that we have gotten to the point where we're trying to be mainstream, but we definitely need to take step two, because if not, animal rights groups are going to jump on it first. And I guarantee that will be the argument.
Yes. Well, That is a scary thought, and I think incredibly well put, and also should make some people a little bit nervous in the way that motivates you rather than makes you hide. I think you hit the nail on the head. Jamie, this is a fascinating conversation. You are a really fascinating individual when it comes to all this. You have an interesting perspective as well. Is there anything that we didn't chat about today that you wanted to wrap up with?
No, man. I think we covered the article. And again, I really appreciate you publishing it. The purpose of the article is not to say like, here's, you know, what you should do or what you should not do. I just want to see more people bring in their cool niche hobbies and say, hey, this could apply to reptiles. Like, you know, if there's a plant person out there who thinks, you know, they're what they keep could really help us. I would love to see an article like this saying, here's, you know, horticulture concepts for, you know, herpeticulture. That'd be super useful for someone like me who's not really a plant person, but would love to learn more. But, you know, maybe if I approach it from a framework that I do understand, like herpeticulture, it would be helpful. So again, I just hope anyone who has some sort of knowledge that they think they can contribute, whether it's breeding or whether it's something completely esoteric, will just write it up and, you know, publish it or put it out there, because that's ultimately the only way we can grow and learn.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, I'll have the published article in the show notes, everybody. Is there anywhere else online? I mean, you and I stay in touch on Instagram, but I don't know if you don't really have animals or anything on there, I don't think. So people, no. Just, if they want to interact with you, they just listen to the episodes.
Yeah, I mean, you can add me on Instagram. Like, I don't have any pictures of the animals on there, but I'm happy to discuss any of this and talk. I love talking it through. And in fact, when Project Herpeticulture dropped, I had a few people that reached out to me, and we've had some great conversations, you know. So definitely feel free to reach out to me on Instagram, and I'm always happy to talk about it.
Awesome. So I'll include that as well. Well, Jamie, thank you so much. This was an absolute pleasure. So thanks for being on the show.
Cool, man. Thanks, Dylan. I appreciate it.
All right, that is the end of that episode. Jamie, thank you so much for jumping on the episode with Phil and Roy back in June and doing this episode with me today, and as well as writing the incredibly thorough and thoughtful article that you wrote on the Animals at Home blog. I think these are really interesting topics. I'd love to hear what the listeners think. Listeners, do you think that we should be comparing the aquarium hobby and the reptile keeping world together? I mean, I do it all the time, and I think maybe it comes because I came from a fish keeping background as well. Maybe if you didn't keep fish, you don't feel any need to do it. I'd be curious to know what you think. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure you share it on social media, Instagram or Facebook. I usually try to repost everything that I can. If you would like to support the podcast, you can do that at patreon.com/animalsathome. There, just for a couple of bucks a month, you can really help me keep the lights on in the studio. Or you can check out Custom Reptile Habitats with the affiliate link that's in the show notes or the YouTube description. If you access their website through that link and make a purchase, a commission comes back to me at no extra cost to you. And of course, that helps me support the show. And that is it for this one, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. I will catch you in the next episode.